It's strange days recently at Russia's defense ministry, where the head of the agency itself was replaced in the last week with an economist. Yes, Vladimir Putin tapped Andrei Removich Belousov to take over for Sergei Shoigu, ending the latter's 12-year tenure as defense minister. And weeks before that announcement, the federal authorities arrested one of Shoigu's senior subordinates, Deputy Defense Minister Timur Ivanov, who is now charged with accepting a bribe in the form of construction services worth more than ₹1 billion, about $11 million. His attorney has told reporters that the case apparently rests on films about Ivanov, possibly referring to Team Navalny's 2022 investigation, alleging that he owns lavish private estates in the Tver region and in and around Moscow that he supposedly built and maintained with contractors paid from the defense ministry's budget. Oops. A day after Putin replaced his defense minister, the feds arrested Lieutenant General Yuri Kuznetsov, the head of the Russian defense ministry's main personnel directorate. He is accused of taking especially large bribes from representatives of commercial structures for performing certain actions on their behalf. How very considerate. Now, with all this going on in the Russian military, we happen to get the publication of new research by David Zacconi, an assistant professor of political science at George Washington University in the United States. And this article is devoted entirely to corruption and co-optation in autocracy, specifically in Russia. The timing is pretty much perfect, so you can imagine how excited I was when David agreed to talk to me here. Welcome to the Naked Pravda. Howdy, folks. I'm your host, Kevin Rothrock, the managing editor of Medusa in English, and welcome back to another episode of this here, Naked Pravda. As I said in my thrilling cold open, this week's guest is Dr. David Zacconi, an assistant professor of political science at George Washington University, and he's also the co-founder of the Anti-Corruption Data Collective. His work focuses on, can you believe it, corruption, illicit financial flows, autocracy, and non-market strategy, and he's got current projects underway on Russia, obviously, that's what we're talking about today. Also Congo, Germany, the UK, and also the US of A. Earlier this month, on May 7th, the American Political Science Review published the article that we're going to be talking about today, Corruption and Co-optation in Autocracy, Evidence from Russia, where Dr. Zacconi tries to ascertain if corrupt State Duma deputies govern differently. And he also tries to establish what the governing costs of such corruption might be. David's methodology will be familiar to listeners who know the techniques of anti-corruption activists like the researchers at Alexei Navalny's Anti-Corruption Foundation. Dr. Zacconi compares lawmakers' public financial disclosures against insurance data and leaked traffic police records. To get at deputies who are too smart to get caught this way, he turns to information about politicians' plagiarized dissertation work, and so on. Now, there are quite a few twists and turns in this research, so rather than have me try and maybe fail to explain it, let's just get to the interview and hear it straight from Dr. Zacconi. My first question has to do with the research question that motivated this article in the first place. And as I understand it, the questions you're asking yourself are, do corrupt officials govern differently in elected office? And what are the governing costs of this corruption? And so my question, again, thinking of what, you know, listeners and readers might have in mind when sitting down or thinking about sitting down to read this is, should they go into this article expecting to learn more about corruption writ large among politicians, or should they expect it to be about corruption specifically in an autocratic state, in an authoritarian context?
My hope is that the article can teach us something about how corruption works everywhere. In academia, at least, we know a lot more about the causes of corruption. You have unfree media or undemocratic elections. Those things can really contribute to a corrupt atmosphere. But we know a lot less about what the consequences of corruption are. How does it affect the way that policymakers make decisions about how budgets are allocated, about how normal people can live their lives and pursue their own goals, when you have a large percentage of officials that are exploiting their own political positions for private gain? You might be surprised that we know comparatively little about that second question, about the consequences of corruption for governance rather than the causes of it. And I think that's what this research agenda is trying to engineer, is to focus the attention on what society should expect and how we might account for the fact that these officials are not necessarily thinking of the public interest in their own positions.
As I understand it, you're borrowing from what investigative journalists and what people practicing forensic economics are doing. But I'd really like to hear you just explain for me and for listeners what it is exactly you're doing with insurance data, with traffic records, and obviously you're working with the officially reported income. I mean, that's kind of the starting point, but you're triangulating it against this insurance data, traffic records. And then to get at people who are maybe too smart to slip up there, you're looking at dissertations and like local regional levels of corruption. And so what are the tricks that you're performing in this research to try to understand where the corruption is?
I'll try to be concise because, as you just said, there's a lot of different data sources that go into this paper. I think a lot of your listeners are going to be familiar with Navalny-type investigations, or FBK, and the way that they've taken leaked data, gray market data, and transformed it into really incisive investigations of individual officials over the last, say, decade and a half. So we know about dachas, we know about luxury cars, because officials' names appear in databases that probably shouldn't be public, but there are a lot of incentives for people within the government to leak that data or sell that data to outside actors. Those investigations have been transformative, and my work would not exist if I wasn't building off what they've done. What's kind of the extension or the expansion is that when you see independent journalism in Russia going after individual officials, you only get one small part of the picture. You get a really kind of long form essay with a ton of different types of evidence and photos and official documents into one or two or three people at a time. And those investigations come out every month or so. But as a social scientist, it's hard to aggregate all that information, especially to say, what does that teach us about the Duma? What does that teach us about the presidential administration when we get these snapshots of different officials at different times? So what I've done in this paper is say, let's look at every single deputy in the Duma and let's start with what they say they own. So real estate, cars, their official income for themselves, their spouses, and their family members. This is in documents that the government has made public since 2008 or so. They're scattered across the internet. You can go to declarator.org and see the massive amount of labor that's been put in to try to aggregate them in one place. But the Russian government makes this stuff public. It doesn't make it easy to find, doesn't make it easy to use, but it puts it on the web. That's the first step. It's just collecting and parsing and standardizing hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of different entries for officials over the last 15 years. It's one of the richest data sources of any country around the world, and it's really surprising that Russia is one of them. And
is that all a legacy of the Medvedev presidency and kind of like they kept putting out the data for several years thereafter?
It's not just several years. Like, yeah, it's a legacy, but it only stopped in 2022. Right. It was a Putin Novigod present in 2022, kind of 9 months into the war. He said, okay, you still have to file these forms, but we're no longer going to make them public. So my research agenda has come to an abrupt end. I'm really more historical than contemporary. But for this paper, I wanted to take advantage of the fact that we knew about these officials. I'm also, I've spent a lot of time in Russia. I know that people aren't going to tell the truth on these forms, and we shouldn't take them at their word. So we need to validate it. And the way you validate it is that you have another external data source that maybe you have more trust in, maybe you have less trust in, but you can at least compare what people are putting on their official declaration form and say what cars they're insured to drive or what real estate records are actually sitting in the cadastre in the Russian government offices. Surprisingly, with cars, a lot of the stuff has leaked into the public sphere. There have been a lot of investigations using GIBIDD data. So the Russian version of the DMV has been really, I would say, publicly available on the web for most Russian citizens in the last 15 years. So that's one part of it. And then the insurance data, I think, is one of the unique contributions of the paper. And that is, there's a website. It's kind of like a trade association for insurers. So for Americans listening, I'm sorry, I don't know all the insurers in Europe, but it'd be like a State Farm and Allstate and all the different commercials that you see when you watch television. They all entered their data into a central database. And you could go in and put in a license plate. And in that license plate, you get back the first name, the middle name, and the first initial and birth date of whatever car you put into that website. And as far as I can surmise, it's because if you get in an accident, you want to figure out whether the other car has insurance, who to contact, if it's a hit and run and you can follow up, you've got a dash cam that recorded the accident, you want to get paid. This website exists in order to facilitate claims being filed from day-to-day accidents. And what I did is I took a list of all the luxury cars that have been registered in Russia that was leaked, and I ran them one by one through this insurance database to try to figure out who the owners are, who the drivers are, who are these cars registered over time, and compared that to what the official disclosures are of what people say they own and what they drove, as well as trying to put a value to all these cars and come up with unique corruption measures based on, one, do people drive cars that cost more than their income should allow them to afford? I know there are loans, there's lots of ways to finance vehicle purchases, but there are also many cases in the Duma and across the Russian government where people just drive fancy cars that there's no logical or legal reason that they should be able to afford. And also, do they drive cars that never show up in their disclosures at all, which happens less often in the Duma, but it happens more often at lower levels. So that's the vibe of the paper, is saying, what can we learn from publicly available data, from gray market data, to try to figure out when people are lying and what they own at scale, rather than just one person at a time every so often during the year, so that we can test larger theories about how corruption works in the government.
And what is it you're doing to try to triangulate the corrupt officials that are too smart to be caught this way? Like, can you explain the dissertation stuff? And the...
Sure. So not every official is going to run out with their bag of cash rubles and go and buy a car. It's, you know, I think most officials like to drive fancy cars. I think there's some conspicuous consumption norms going on. But if you're smart, you're going to set up an offshore company. You're going to buy a palace somewhere outside of Russia, you're going to squirrel your money away. And there's very little that I can say about that, right? There's not transparency globally that we can track these assets for, say, 1,400 people over 15 years. That's just impossible. So what I can say is that this car-based measure, this 24% of Duma deputies that I've found, it correlates with other dimensions of dishonesty that we know from other sources. So your readers might be familiar with DISRNet, this incredible project over the last 10 years to take all the dissertations that have ever been filed by public officials and run them through basic plagiarism software and flag the ones that do not meet conventional academic norms, to say politely, you know, that have been plagiarized. And what we find is that indicator that deputies that are more likely to plagiarize their dissertations are also more likely to have problems with their cars, as in they drive fancier cars than they might be able to afford. And then also, you know, deputies that come from more corrupt regions, where maybe the norms there are for, you know, like embezzlement or different types of machinations, they're also more likely to kind of have this red flag pop up on my own measure. So it's capturing corruption, but also capturing dishonesty, capturing kind of this slipperiness. Yes, it could be a little bit of incompetence. Maybe they're not smart enough to like know what a corporate service provider is and what lawyer to call in the UK. But not every deputy has those opportunities. And I think I'm capturing people that are vulnerable, that have compromise on them, that the officials can just go look in this authority. And, like, he drives a Porsche and he has a salary of 70,000 rubles a month or 120,000 rubles a month. There's a disconnect here. Let's keep an eye on him or her, and we can potentially use this information against them down the line.
Did your findings, did they conform to what you expected in terms of demographics, or were you surprised by anything you found?
Men definitely seem to drive fancier cars than women. But that said, the average cost of a car for female deputies is still way higher than, you know, the normal Moscow citizen. The party differences were kind of interesting. LDPR comes out really bad in this, but that also, I have to say, conforms to my expectations. Some of the biggest seat-selling scandals since United Russia really started to take over the Duma have been with LDPR. When they're caught, it's, you know, $8 million for a spot on the LDPR party list. Again, maybe it's not a surprise that on my measures, LDPR comes out pretty badly. And the communists, they're not necessarily blue-collar workers, but they tend to drive less fancy cars or cars that are within their means. And United Russia falls somewhere in between. So it's hard to say what my expectations were. We don't really have any data on this at scale for any government institution in Russia. So a bit of this is just kind of like laying out the landscape and showing who may be abusing their office more or less while they're in position.
So at this point, some listeners might be thinking, oh, this is another example of Russia being a failed state, like they can't keep their house in order. But one of the takeaways from your article is this is really all part of the plan, that the state is deliberately maintaining this diversity of deputies, of lawmakers, with the intent of keeping people vulnerable so that they can be controlled. So can you lay down for listeners why this is engineered this way? Why the authorities are essentially happy to have these Kompromat officials?
I think there's two reasons. One is the diversity that you talked about. You need people to write laws. You need people to go on camera and talk to journalists, to get in front of constituents, to win elections. And often that requires real political skill. And those politicians can't be spending all day cutting deals with outside actors or looking for different loopholes in order to benefit themselves. They actually need to be engaged with the business of lawmaking. I'm sure they're well compensated for that, but you need the diversity in the Duma in that if everybody was like that, then you'd have a really raucous chamber and lots of different ideas thrown out there and people voting by their conscience rather than the party line or what the regime wants. You need this combination of active, ambitious, capable legislators with docile, obedient, compromised legislators that will just vote how they're told to, or really understand that their continued political or financial careers depends on a certain type of behavior in office. And I think that's critical to not just the Duma, to a lot of Russian institutions. There's this combination of the competent and the incompetent. And that's what makes the edifice stand even under incredible pressure. And I've got a lot of their work trying to unpack that issue, is that there's just a lot more diversity within the Russian government than we, I think, oftentimes as outsiders appreciate. And that diversity helps contribute to regime longevity and also to the bad decision-making that we've seen so often. So that's the first thing. And then I'll talk about the second one, which is quite different, but it, I think, is also interesting. And that is that, like, data facilitates surveillance. And a big question for a lot of us studying Russia under Putin is that there's been this open data, at least before the war. There's just incredible transparency about so many different elements of the government. And I think this paper is trying to argue that the government benefits from that transparency, that it's collecting information initially on its own officials and now on its own citizens in order to exercise societal and political control in unexpected ways, and learning a lot from the Chinese government in doing so. And I think the idea that you have all these officials disclose their assets and you collect information on their cars and their real estate and that you monitor and oversee this empowers the autocratic government to enforce control in a nuanced and, I think, really powerful way that's critical to autocratic regimes. So it's data, 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 surveillance, surveillance, surveillance. Like, this is a reason why it produced the realms of data, at least before the war. Now, post-war, I think it's a different set of security concerns, and not all this is being shared publicly, but that's one hypothesis I have about why there's been so much openness. There was so much openness before 2022.
Would you say that your findings, do they undermine or do they support what I assume is sort of the common assumption or perception abroad of the State Duma, that it's basically just a rubber stamp legislature? Because, you know, I mean, on one hand, we have lawmakers being successfully co-opted. We have a very sort of managed legislature. But on the other hand, we have business interests and security services bothering to court these people. And so in that sense, it seems like the lawmakers are maybe more empowered than we might expect. But, like, is this the rubber stamp story, or is this more nuanced or different?
I think it depends on the type of legislation being discussed. For major pieces of legislation, ones that affect, you know, Russia's national security or that are really being promulgated from the Kremlin, the Duma acts very much as a rubber stamp type of body. But there's a lot of domestic policy issues that are divisive, that expose rifts and cause clans and different groups to really get at each other's throats. And the Duma has been a mechanism for resolving or at least communicating some of these divisions and getting them out in under discussion and have different special interests promote what they want and lobby. And I think that's really critical. And, you know, honestly, that's very similar to a lot of how democratic institutions work. We have in America, we have, you know, high politics and routine politics, high politics and big insurance battles and Medicare. You know, they have a very different political flavor than what is the appropriate level of this chemical in the water, or what is the kind of right train regulation. Those involve a lot of special interests and a lot of battles that never make it in the public sphere. Same with Russia. There's a lot of what we might think of as routine politics where the Duma has a much more representative function, maybe not of voters, but of special interests. And it contributes to the policymaking seen in a meaningful way. It's just hard to see sometimes, is this an issue that has just been forced down the throat and had zero discussion? Or is this law as a product of a lot of behind the scenes battling and discussions and lobbying? We don't get to go behind the curtain and figure out which law is which, but I think this paper suggests that there are occasions where the Duma really plays a bigger policy role, and there are other occasions where it takes a back seat to the presidential administration, which dictates.
Does that divide you describe between sort of high politics and lower politics, is that graft onto the division you mentioned in your article between sort of lobbyist deputies who are working with largely corporate special interests and these kompromat deputies who are working with the security services? Like, are the kompromat deputies generally more engaged in the high politics and the lobbyist deputies are, and I assume we're talking about this as though they're like two separate species of like creatures or something, but there probably is overlap and so on. But is that a worthwhile sort of way of thinking of it?
I don't think the kompromat deputies are being entrusted with the major legislative proposals. I think they're really kind of backbenchers in that way. I think they are competing with some of the other corporate interests. And when there's bills about budgets, they might represent a more security agency perspective about how money should be spent or how taxation should be leveled. So I think they're much more competing with the other special interests. And then the high politics are a lot more kind of like, this is a new privacy law, or this is a new law against foreign agents, or whatever it's going to be. I don't think there's a lot of necessary lobbying on that type of stuff. I think it's being handed down from above. But there is this space underneath where corporate and security interests and even some type of other societal interests are being represented potentially indirectly through deputies. I wish I knew a bit more about how this happens. We have some interviews. Things are really closed right now. But there's been a lot of work from, say, like Ben Noble, who's really kind of found different ways of calculating and identifying the way that that legislation changes and special interests are actually working behind the scenes.
What is the takeaway here regarding specifically the security services? Because I know, you know, you're looking at evidence of people with ill-gotten, you know, gains in property, essentially. How are you then able to extrapolate that to anything regarding the security services?
I think the paper says less about the security services and more about how the systemic opposition has more connections to the security services than we might expect. And the bigger question there is that I view, as a product of a bunch of other projects I'm doing, is that the systemic opposition operates more like a free agent than we might give it credit for. And there are internal divisions in many of the systemic opposition parties. And they're being pulled towards the regime and towards a more conventional opposition type of activity. For now, I think this free agent has signed a long-term contract with the regime. I don't think that there's any possibility that they're going to defect or challenge the regime in any meaningful way. But this type of research uncovers potential fault lines within these parties, that they have diverse interests, and that in the event of regime change, you might expect some members of the systemic opposition to gravitate toward a new power center, that their fates are not inextricably tied to the regime. And I think that is one of these really puzzling elements of the Russian political scene, is like, what do we do with the communists? What do we do with LDPR? What do we do with Just Russia? Are they just fictitious, Surkov created bodies that don't really play any meaningful role? Or are they semi-autonomous? Do they have other interests that are bubbling from within? And I think this and another kind of research that I've been really invested in is trying to show that they have these free agent-like qualities, but they're right now they understand that their fortunes are much better off if they continue with allegiance to the regime rather than some other position.
You're modeling your research on the tactics that anti-corruption activists have pioneered or developed over the last several years in Russia specifically. One of the criticisms that's emerged of Team Navalny and others sort of focusing on anti-corruption since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine is that this kind of activism is no longer as effective, that it's a lower priority in terms of what's going on in the region. Does this have any impact on the nature of your research?
I have two things to say, one based on the paper and one based on other research. The first is, I think we all have a responsibility to uncover the corruption that's happening right now in Russia's government. It's impossible to envision a transition to a better future unless we understand which officials perform more honestly and which less honestly under Putin, because there's not going to be a wholesale change in bureaucracy that people are going to survive. And they're going to transition into a new government. So I think this type of investigative work is critical. And I am less agreeable to a lot of the critiques that, you know, these investigations have played out, that there's some saturation, you're not changing anybody's minds. I think it is still really purposeful and important work to figure out how corruption acts as a glue within the current government.
Is that to like inform the future lustration or the limited lustration? You said you're not going to replace everybody, or is, because it doesn't seem like it has much public resonance anymore.
I think it's reached a tipping point, right? I don't think there's that many people that are open to new information about corruption in the Russian government. But I think if you're ever going to eradicate corruption in a future government, you need to understand how it worked in the current government and what institutions need to be strengthened, what laws worked, what laws didn't work. This is one of the, you know, top three problems in Russia. So I don't think we should just kick our foot off the gas because people seem to have already formed concrete opinions about how it works. The second one is kind of previewing research, which I'm hesitant to do because it hasn't been peer reviewed, but it's a paper that I hope to have out in the next year. And that is, when anti-corruption activists were given the chance to take real power, and I look at the example of the Moscow municipal elections in 2017, where they actually took local power, and it wasn't a lot of power, but they controlled councils throughout the city. I have research showing that they governed really well, and they actually reduced the corruption in the ruling party, and they made public procurement more competitive. So there is this connection between anti-corruption activism and governing ability that we don't have a lot of evidence for, but I think I've got some new research saying we should focus on some of these issues outside of government, because when you do get into government, you can have real impact and improve the quality of life for citizens, even at the municipal level in Moscow. You know, those deputies don't have a lot of levers to pull. So I, not just from a self-interested point of view, I think we should be continuing to discuss corruption and uncovering corruption and talking about the mechanisms by which it undergirds the Putin political stability. Because just look at Ivanov in the last 2 months. Like, there's the perfect example of kompromat being brought up in order to play a number of different political roles, and all of these officials kind of falling under the hammer under the guise of an anti-corruption investigation, but it's being used strategically. And I think this is one of the key ways that Putin punishes and enforces obedience is through this anti-corruption purported mechanism. So we need to better understand about what he knows about his own officials and how useful that will be going forward in order to enforce this loyalty. So I see these as kind of critical questions to regime survival, how well you manage the corruption and use it strategically. And I don't think we should be looking otherwise and saying, look, we know everything we know, and people's opinions aren't going to change. We need to focus on other issues.
Thanks for tuning in, folks. This has been The Naked Pravda, a podcast from Medusa in English. Remember that undesirable status back in Russia means our entire news outlet now relies on readers and listeners around the world to support our work. Please visit our website for information about how to become a contributor with one-time or recurring pledges. Thanks again. Until next week.